Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Last week's
episode. Oh yeah, we did Mother's Day. It was last
week.
What?
I absolutely loved it. It was. I knew I was in a safe place so that I could ask her things I've always wanted to ask her. But you were so responsive.
Of course.
Yeah.
I am very responsive.
Because there was a mic. If I was just chatting to you, I don't think you would have said, like, yeah, let's talk about this.
I would.
Yeah, it was lovely. It was lovely to just talk to my mother a bit about our crazy life.
It was really lovely, actually, because you just don't take that time.
So what are we making today?
When I say we, now I'm going to be very clear about this, I have hardly had anything to do with cooking today. So Randell and Chili and now Cinnamon have been holding down the kitchen absolute
nobody's business.
And someone very important that's coming around, Jay Rayner, a colleague of Mother's on Radio 4's Kitchen Cabinet.
My friend
and a very good friend of Mum's. So she's she wants things right.
I want it right.
She wants things
right. Well, I was going to ask you this, Keats, first, because we know what happens when chefs come around. So is it the same for food critics? Are we in that? Is Mum in the same space?
It's definitely, I know that space.
What is this space? What is the space?
Just a little jittery. Little on edge. My colleagues are coming around, my peers. I kept calling Jay a chef actually today, and I was like, he is not a chef, he's the food critic of the nation. So we have had chefs, and it'd be really nice to talk to him about the nuance of that, because he has a completely different job.
I've noticed a pattern. When it is chefs or peers, you reach for the soul food. Like,
yes,
you know you can do
true,
it better
actually.
Than the rest of them.
Yes, that's absolutely, I'm like, well, there's no point, you know, Tommy Banks and Paul Ozer's coming on. There's no point trying to do the fancy schmancy, that kind of fancy. I'm going to hit you where it hurts. Do you know what I mean? You've got to hit them in the belly.
And so with that in mind, what have we got?
We're making planting a coconut fungi, because I don't think Jay's ever had fungi, so I really wanted to, like, introduce him to fungi. We've got stout braised oxtail.
We're having Friday night wine because he's a food critic. I just feel like a bit of a fool giving him some sort of red cocktail. I was like, let's just get you some Barolo, some Fleury, some Pinot Noir, and you take your pick, Jay Rayner.
Everyone's on their tippy toes about Jay, right?
Do you know what? I just want him to be happy. They're coming all the way from South London. It's quite far. It's a big schlep. We tried to get them here before. It didn't work because it took too long to get them here. So they're finally coming. And
I just want it to be right.
So finally.
Finally.
Welcome to Stirring Up, welcome to our house.
Second time round. The you've been on Kitchen Cabinet 10
years.
If we can get you.
Delightful.
Because you're very busy. But
well, the fact that you invented her, I think you should be able to get her.
God.
Makita, I mean, I didn't invent Andy Oliver.
No, of course
but
not.
I do think the brilliant thing about the Kitchen Cabinet is it is a fantastic launch pad.
Yeah.
And so many people from it. I mean, you've already had five careers
before
that.
Before, yes.
But I do think people did hear you on that and go,
it's true.
I mean, absolutely, Jay.
And so, if you could find space in your diary,
that would be really quite fair.
Right, let me just get this out of my gob. So, stout braised oxtail, Guinness braised oxtail, stout braised oxtail, oxtail and butter beans, which is the kind of classic thing, is the oxtail and butter beans, but we use Guinness to add loads of butter and, you know, do the thing. And then we've made fungi.
which I'm always wanging on about in the kitchen cabinet, and you've never had it. So I've made plantain and coconut fungi with fried plantain and crispy onions, and then we've got just butter braised leeks with crispy leeks and leek oil.
I think Mum wanted to feed both of your souls this
morning. I was like, it's the end of a long week. It's been really cold. Yes. We need food that, you know,
that's
does
a
the
shirt
thing.
Destroying.
There's a
stupid.
Yes, it is. Yes, tuck
well,
it
not
in.
Not for all of us, darling.
It is for me. And
would
Jane.
You like to talk now about my dribbling, my sauce dribbling?
Oh, are you a dribbler? Is he a bit of a dribbler?
Well, it comes in the family as well, because his mum was the same.
But
she would never get to the end of a meal without something down her front. And when Jay and I went on honeymoon to Italy 350 years ago.
Right.
It became a running joke that you never got to the end of the meal. You bought loads of new shirts to go away with. You didn't get to the end of a single meal.
I feel like it's the sign of a meal well enjoyed. Yeah, you've got a spoon there.
Here.
Well, clearly I hate
there.
My food.
No, I totally need that for a
can I ask a question?
Because of your wonderful job as Britain's most loved food critic.
Yeah, keep it going.
beloved. respected, powerful, powerful work you
powerful,
do in this
powerful.
World.
Please.
Sorry, Pat.
Please.
I imagine you have to eat publicly a lot. I imagine you get quite a bit of attention. So I would always be like on my
best.
I
love it.
But I mean, then you not dribble or do you not give a shit?
Again, I will turn to Pat. So in restaurants, do I dribble, Pat?
Yes.
In a word.
I mean, you don't dribble. Actually, let's get it.
Splash.
It's not dribble.
Splash.
It's the dropping of the food.
Yes. Right.
I think it's all to do with enthusiasm.
Are you always plus one?
No, God, no. Hardly ever. I'm not welcome on most reviews,
you're not
actually,
welcome?
Because I behave badly, because I won't play the game, which is to be a little passive-aggressive with the waiters when they ask you how things are. You have to say fine. And I understand why, because he cannot give...
An answer.
He can't.
Oh, right.
But unfortunately, he's my husband.
Yes.
And I find it rude. Whereas other people who go with Jay think, oh, this is cool. It's all part of the game.
And you're like, don't talk to people like that.
How the hell did you meet? Because you have been married or together since 1987?
Together since
87.
Married in 92.
That is nearly my whole life.
Yeah.
Oh, bless. How are things going?
Not to be honest, it's almost nearly our entire life.
Well, you must have been babies and just...
No, I really wasn't, but...
But I was.
Older than he is. Not hugely, but...
Okay.
Enough.
Quite a bit.
Mum and God. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, quite a bit.
But he was 20 when we met and I was 24. So that I think at that point...
You're the same.
Same
crap. Well, no.
No, I was barely out of puberty.
No, sorry. That's a man at 20.
I was trained
to be a
teacher.
That's a man at 20.
The sun went down, child. I woke up.
It was at Leeds. We were both at university. I was doing a postgraduate teaching course and he was in his final year. And I have to say... He absolutely took my breath away the moment he walked. I saw him from across a room, a huge pub, and he walked in and he was, I have to tell you, he was stunning. He had the sort of classic 80s kind of slick back, beautiful black hair.
Yeah, he got a good head of hair.
It was great. He was in a massive greatcoat, fedora, rings on his fingers.
Fedora?
Rings on his fingers.
Excuse me.
He walked over, came and said hello, and was just the most fun. Yeah.
All right, so the story of our wedding day is a good one.
Mm.
Because, so we were getting married at Marylebone Registry Office. A few days before our wedding, June 92, I'd interviewed a writer called Kinky Friedman.
It was great.
He was a country and western singer and he wrote detective novels.
He was around a lot.
Yeah, he was around a lot at that time. And they to do the interview, they hired this classic car for me to interview him in, a classic American car. And I thought it was so cool. I booked one of their cars, a 1956 pink Cadillac.
Oh, shit.
And on the day...
Classy.
We're putting out the rubbish. Remember the driver saying, this is the first time I've picked up a wedding couple and they've been putting out the bins. Well, we were very practical kids.
We wouldn't want to come back to full bins.
Well,
quite.
That
was better to do.
And so this beautiful, massive boat of a thing pulls up. We get in and we set off and we're motoring along. We set off 45 minutes early. We are often early to things. And we get as far as Victoria. Massive traffic on a Saturday. Car stops still. At which point we discover it is the first Euro Gay Pride.
Oh, my God.
And London is gridlocked. And we are in a pink Cadillac. And there were at various points as we pulled through this traffic at glacial speed, people would see the pink Cadillac and they would blow their whistles and then look in and spot one of each. At one point in Hyde Park, I got out of the car and ran to a police car and said, can you help us? It's our wedding night.
The thing to remember is that this is before mobile phones.
Yeah, before mobile phones.
Of course, so you couldn't even call people and say, we're on the way, we're late. Like we did last time, where you got stuck.
And we were really late.
40 minutes.
To your own wedding.
Mm-hmm. To our own wedding. The saving grace was, and I'm just going to give this context, my late mother was very fucking famous. My late mother was Claire Rayner, and if you've never heard of her, have a look at her wiki page, because it's all accurate.
No, we'll be talking about her.
All right, okay. And she basically went to the registrar. We had the last slot and said, you are not leaving until my son and his bride are married.
And they went, my God, it's Claire Rayner, do as you're told.
Yeah. And we'd agreed, instead of doing standard wedding photographs, I got a guy from The Independent, because I was working there at the time, to shoot it as if it was a story.
Oh, nice.
And the first shot is us two pelting it round the corner onto Marylebone Road. Because we'd abandoned the car just round the corner at the traffic lights.
So you were like, just use the narrative that is here. We are late. Actually, we are running in.
There's one shot before it. There's a couple of shots before it, which was all the people waiting on the steps. Mm. And literally, he's got one of our friend Clem, who was going to be one of our witnesses, and she's standing there, looking into the distance. And I've always meant to ask her, you did pose that, didn't you? It's such a wistful kind of, you know,
just filming. Just waiting for the horizon.
Where the fuck are they on their wedding day?
So you're talking about your mum. I was quite impressed when I went into menopause because I didn't. When I met you, I wasn't in menopause.
Yeah, we've been working together so long.
Wow, that's amazing.
And then I became menopausal.
I had nothing to do with
that. But you were so knowledgeable about it.
Oh, was I?
Yeah. And you said also because of your mum always talking about everything.
Should we establish just for people who don't know who Claire Rayner was? Because my mum was telling me about her and I had her.
An agony aunt doesn't really describe it, does it?
No, she was a sex advice columnist, agony aunt. But she was at a time when mass media reached out in a way, and it was a sort of one-way street, really. So she was on The Sun writing their problem page from 72 to about 82.
Whoa.
Then The Sunday Mirror for 5 years, and then Today. But she was also on TVAM, and she was on TV when there were only three channels.
But she was remarkable because she was really honest and very direct. I mean, I remember that as a kid, sort of being quite kind of compelled by this whenever she was talking because she was telling
the
truth.
One of the brilliant things is when I met Pat, she didn't quite know.
No, I did. I did. I just hadn't. I mean, I'm terrible. I don't pay attention. I've never paid attention to what's on telly and the media. Not really. Yeah. She wasn't just a sex advice columnist. She was an amazing spokesperson for people, for marginalised groups.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the most striking moments actually when we had the memorial for her. And there was a film of clips of her that were put together. And the very first one, which I'd never seen, was from, I think, the late 60s. She's got a beehive.
Nice.
And she's talking to some kind of old white bloke. He was talking about the love between gay people in 68. Right. I think it must have been just when it had been legalised or very shortly afterwards. And she was impassioned. It was about sort of, you know, how wrong it is that people shouldn't be able to love who they want.
Yeah.
That's 68.
In 68, on telly.
How long it was, but you know, that to become okay.
As a woman speaking that kind of forcefully, that's what I remember is this kind of forceful energy and nature, which I really responded to as a kid. I kind of needed that.
Yeah.
Well, that's the kind of voice you want to hear, isn't it?
Absolutely.
As a young girl,
absolutely.
As a young woman, you want to hear women who really got a voice and take up space on their own.
No, she was absolutely superb. So I think Agony Aunt, because I think we kind of find that a sort of almost amusing title.
Yes. Well, it sounds much bigger. It sounds small, and she certainly wasn't that in her.
You've got to remember, this was a time when you had no sources of information.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, talk to our kids about how you couldn't always go online and find stuff out.
Mm-hmm. You had to get the encyclopedias out.
And, you know, 1,000 people wrote in a week and 1,000 people got a reply. Claire had an operation and it was a part of her contract that every letter would get a reply. And there were 4 or 5 secretaries in the house. The house was a hub, an industrial hub, answering people.
Did you feel proud of her?
Oh, hugely. Okay. I mean, she was also annoying. She was my mother.
I mean, she was your mum. Yeah.
You know what that's like, Makita.
Absolutely. I'm with you, Jay.
A joy.
An absolute joy.
Can I say, by the way, this oxtail stew...
It's wonderful.
It's wonderful. If you did enter this in competitions, there's a reason for saying that. I'm taking more.
You
would, of course, win.
We had a question this week on the kitchen counter about what would you cook if you were cooking something and entering into competition. And I was torn between the curry goat and the stout braised oxtail, and I went with the stout braised oxtail.
Okay. And you, and Jay's saying you're a winner.
And he's saying I would have won.
Wow. Yeah, you, okay. In a competition of oxtail, you know, braised oxtail. Yeah.
Just to be clear, I would have won.
It's a winning meal.
It's a winning dish, just to be very, very clear.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Can I talk a little bit about what you do? Because it's in academia, is it not?
I work as a commissioning editor for academic books. So for books that are used by researchers and students. And effectively they are the way that researchers publish their work and their ideas. So I publish on history and archaeology, law, education, museum studies.
Is it good that you're in such different...
Sexy.
I mean, so how many years have you
it's
been...
It's not sexy, I'm very...
What are we saying? How many years have you been together?
950.
950 years, which is quite interesting to me. Because I'm like, how do you do that? Because when you talk about Pat, I'm not saying this to embarrass you, but whenever you talk about Pat, there is a kind of underlying constancy and connected thing that you don't do when you talk about other people that I find really quite endearing. It's really, really lovely. And I'm just amazed that you still have that after 950 years.
We do appear to.
Do you think there's a... What is it?
All right, let's be exact. For anybody who's irritated by that, 5 years together, 32 years of marriage on top.
Actually, the story about how we did eventually get together is the story of our marriage, actually, and why it's interesting. So I had been away from Leeds for a while. I had come in, I was doing teacher training, and I'd met some new people on this teacher training. And there were sort of these groups that all seemed to tie up various people that I knew. So it's mid-1980s, and I get people around for a video night, remember that?
Right?
And when it was still exciting.
Pressure.
And there weren't many. There was probably about 6 or 7. What I didn't know was that I had actually cut across 2 groups of people who loathed each other.
Oh.
I knew them separately. They absolutely loathed each other. One of those people was Jay's then girlfriend. So she was one of them. Anyhow, the whole evening was a disaster. Well, I mean, thankfully we had things to watch.
It was
silence in the room. I didn't know what I'd done. There was a knock at the door. The knock at the door was Jay. Fedora man coming to find his girlfriend.
Oh.
Right? So he walks in, and it's a tiny room, lots of people who hate each other packed into it.
Nowhere to sit. Good energy so far.
Yeah, nowhere left to sit except on the floor. So Jay and I sit on the floor, and we basically spend the next hour and a half.
We started a conversation that's been going for 37 years.
Yeah, and it was just brilliant. We had a fabulous chat, and that was it. And, you know, frankly, ex-girlfriend,
please. But that's interesting, just one conversation. You're like, yeah.
Well, it lasted about an hour and a half while seven people watched us.
Yes. Oh, my God, of course you're the only people in the hate room talking.
We're actually talking in the room of hate, in the house of hate. I want to talk about music.
Well, that was the other thing, because what you've heard so far, if you're listening and don't know us, is there's Raina, who does that thing on MasterChef and Kitchen Camera and writes reviews, and there's Pat, who is an academic publisher who...
Terribly serious. Fantastic beats. But actually, there's a jazzy side hustle here. And I don't mean because of jazz music, I mean just like, there's a funky extra.
There's a huge thing in your life
that you love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you did something the other day.
Oh, no, I didn't really.
You did. No, it was very sweet. Because you walked into the green room when we were embarrassing everyone, was doing Kitchen Cabinet. And you walked in, and you started talking to somebody, and Dr. Annie Gray, our dear friend and colleague, went, there's a piano over there, and you went, Yamaha, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he literally didn't even turn around. And he'd walked into the room, he'd literally walked past it for a millisecond. Yeah. And
I'm obsessed with pianos.
Mum said,
she was like, you don't get it. Like, when he talks about pianos, his whole being lights up. I was like, okay, tell me about it. We've never even talked about it.
I started playing when I was... I started having lessons when I was 10, but one of the things we discovered when we got together was that this woman has a voice on her. A proper voice.
You stood not a chance.
God, imagine if you really like someone, you fancy them, you think they're wonderful, and then they open their mouth and they can really sing. It's like, it's over.
So now, and I'm going to give the end point now, and then we can go back. Well, it's called the J. Rayner Sextet, because it's my fault.
What's it called? The J. Rayner?
Sextet. That's six of us, including you.
And did you fall in love with music straight away, Jay? Because, I mean, it really does seem to be this thing that's such a kind of massive love in your life.
It doesn't start, does it?
There's no start and finish.
No.
I mean, it's just a part of it. And just to be absolutely clear, I have this joke, which I do at the beginning of our gigs, which is I'm the greatest jazz pianist in Britain of all the judges on MasterChef. It's good because it's true.
Yes.
But
yes.
And it was always a good line to get me through saying, why have you come to see that bloke you've seen on MasterChef or read in the reviews? A lot of my development as a musician, I've got a bit of yours as a singer because I think you were fully formed. But you weren't, all right. But a lot of mine has happened through the good offices of the brilliant guy. And I'm going to name check them all.
Go on.
Dave Lewis on sax, Chris Cobson on guitar, Sophie Alloway on drums, Robert Rickenberg on bass, who have all played, you know, Dave was John Martin's saxophonist. Sophie Alloway plays with Gala now. Chris Cobson is Courtney Pines. Rob Rickenberg has played with both the Minogues.
Both the Minogues. Danny and Kylie.
They're brilliant and they're astonishing. And I learn. I think we learn everything with them in the 12 years, the 11 years we've been.
It's 12, John.
12 years.
Oh, was that a decision? Did you start this and then, Pat, you...
There's a story.
Yeah, of course.
There's a story and everything. I love this.
So the story, I have played for a very long time. At one point, we did a piano vocal duo thing, which our very kind friends paid tickets to come and see. It wasn't bad, I don't think.
Was it just you two that
one? Yeah, we were just failing to make children, so we decided to do something else.
Have a creative baby.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that was a long time ago. And I did a night class at Goldsmiths. I was tutored by various people. I was on the one show from 2009, and I'd be live on the couch every Friday night. And then I would go into the Ivy Club, fancy, wanky West End club, where a very old friend of mine from university, Joe Thompson, was the house pianist. And he knew that I played. And he would have a trio on those Friday nights of a really top-of-the-tree musician.
At the Ivy?
At the Ivy Club.
The
Prime Members Club. And it was a great room because you would have significant people in there. I remember one night when Sting was down the end of the bar. He sent a note up the bar saying, I love what the trio's doing. Mm. The trio played Shape of Your Heart back at him.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Okay. Do you remember that?
I loved that.
And they played it perfectly.
Oh, nice.
And the guitar part was Chris, who is now with us. Anyway, the one Friday, I'd go and sit there and listen. One Friday night, Joe got up and said, it's your turn. I said, what do you mean? He said, sit in. I played the chords to All of Me, and it was all I could do. And I was terrified, but it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And I wanted it again. So I went away for that week and I made sure I could play both the tune and the chords. And I came back and said, I can do it. And that became my the biggest part of my jazz lessons. Week after week, I went back to that room with a new tune that I'd learnt that week. I would sit down and I would, can I play this with other people? And I would build a repertoire of stuff, and I loved it.
But in front of a crowd every time?
Well, maybe there'd be 50 people in the room, and they'd like it.
Because they'd be chatting and talking. Yes, and right. So sometimes they'd notice.
I always think and a small also, crowd is more difficult than a big crowd.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, for me. But that intimacy, I haven't sung for years, but when I used to sing a lot, 25, 30, 40 people in the room was much more terrifying because you could see the whites of their eyes than a big room where there's massive lights and you can't even see them.
This had the benefit of being a free form. It wasn't a jam. It was an unstructured gig.
Yeah.
And people knew that they didn't have to pay attention. Yeah. If you made the room turn to you, that was a thing.
Then you'd done a thing,
Pat
right.
started singing. With us.
Yeah, I did. I
love it here to stay, black coffee.
That way in.
Nice.
And so there was performance going on. I am then asked to do a thing called 5 by 15. I don't know if you know it. It's five people who are asked to do a talk about a personal passion for 15 minutes.
It's like a TED talk, really.
Yeah, it's like a small TED talk.
Oh, yes.
And I think they probably expected me to want to talk about Bray's daughter or something. And I said, is there a piano? And they said, yes. I said, okay. I want to talk about playing one of those for 30 years and not being very good. Because we don't talk about the things we love but aren't very good at. And fine. So I talked about that for 9 minutes, my love of the object, my love of being in a room with pianos and all of that. And then Robert Rickenberg, who I'd been playing bass with at the Ivy Club, came on and we played All of Me. And I thought that would be the last thing I would ever do in front of an audience. And at the end, a woman from Jewish Book Week came up and said, that was brilliant. Can you do an hour? And I said, well, I can't do I'm Crap, but thank you for listening for an hour. And then in what I still regard as the greatest piece of festival commissioning I've ever come across, she said, OK, take a year.
Oh, my God.
Don't do it
clever.
This year. Do it next. And I said, yes.
That is clever.
And I went away and we already had the beginnings of a set. We needed 10 tunes.
But only that's because we've been doing them vaguely at the club. Nothing.
That's almost like what like old-timey record companies used to do. Yeah. Like when they used to actually develop a band and start, you know, how long did it take you two to get successful? 15 albums, whatever.
February 2012, we did our first gig. It was a quartet, saxophonist Dave Lewis, bassist Rob Rickenberg. Could only really afford two musicians, decided to have a percussive bassist and a drummer. Pat singing. And that video is still online. And if I look back at it, I'm not ashamed of it.
That's fantastic news.
And we did that. And we sort of came off and went, that can't be the end. And we built it and built it.
And you bloody love it.
And we've gone Sunday lunches at Ronnie Scott's. We now have a residency at Pizza Express.
So there used to be loads of places to play all over, not just London, but the country, and loads of them have gone.
I mean, I sometimes wonder about the size of the jazz world because we feel sometimes that we know literally everybody who's gigging on a particular night. We are pretty deeply embedded now in that world, and it's lovely. Although of a particular age demographic, because there's another generation younger than us, the Tomorrow's Warriors kids, who are fantastic.
Ezra Collective.
Absolutely fantastic. There's a whole another world there, but I think we've sat in with the Kansas Smithies, we've had Giacomo Smith, the Kansas Smithies, depth with us, Adrian Cox, and all these sort of people. I love these people. And I also have to say, music festivals, jazz festivals, are so much more fun than literary festivals.
Oh,
there's always the big beasts who are selling so much more than you are, and you're all in a...
I had a great time. Last year I did a book tour, my first book tour. You interviewed me on one of them. And I enjoyed it. I really liked it, but I was just like, this is like... For a start, it's so white.
Yes.
The big festivals you go
jazz,
to.
You don't get that in jazz.
Not so much. Well, I mean, when we did that Jazz 65, do you remember we did the thing at Cheltenham? We did Jazz 65 just quickly. It was a recreation of the first show that was ever on BBC Two.
Fantastic.
You know, and it was absolutely brilliant. But again, it's like all the black people were on the stage and all the white people were in the audience. There was one black person in the audience, and it was Garfield.
I remember actually... You know, so talking about that when we were watching it, it was kind of like jaw-dropping,
well,
actually.
Bringing Jazz 65 back and having a completely white audience.
That's how it always was, like, same as it ever was. It's a very, like, that dynamic
doesn't
change.
I would have thought there would have been some more because it was in the middle of the Cheltenham Festival that year. The band was great.
Gregory Porter.
Oh, Gregory was there.
Gregory Porter was
there. Do you
like
the way I just called him by his first name?
Yeah, yeah.
Gregory,
didn't we're like you that do a thing with him
Gregory.
At Cheltenham?
Yeah, I did do a thing you with him it. At Cheltenham.
Oh, did you?
Actually, that's one of the things about the Cheltenham Jazz Festival. You go to the literary festivals and there's Julian Barnes holding court in some corner, whereas Gregory Porter is in the bar with everybody
else. With everybody, God, yeah. And singing a bit and doing a bit.
It's a very different
out.
Energy.
Yeah.
We're doing a show at Cheltenham Jazz Festival this year. And we booked him for the night before as well. And it's essentially going to be a hang with a gig at the end of it.
Nice.
And I kind of turned back at one point and said, you will come back wrecked but happy.
Wrecked but happy. I want to be wrecked but happy. I'm sure I might be able to scrounge up. It's my mate's birthday.
We're 120 years old between us.
What's really interesting is generally the gigs at Pizza Express that we do are midweek.
Yeah.
And both of us have to get up for ordinary work the next day.
So there's no hang.
And to be honest, all of our musicians as well, because they're working so hard, they're straight off. They don't do the hanging anyway. But we're wrecked for the rest of the week, aren't we? You know, certainly the next day. It's like the number of times that I'm sitting at my desk trying to think something useful, and it's just not possible because it's such a, you know, sort of singing on stage.
It takes a lot.
It's a visceral kind of physical activity.
We do a two-hour show.
But also, you do a two-hour set?
No, we do not do two-hour sets.
Hour 40?
We're there for two hours.
Two sets.
I see.
One is an hour and the other one is about 55 minutes.
Really?
I know, you're having so much fun, you barely notice the clock.
Exactly, he's got the clock going. It never feels that
you
long.
Know, actually, one of the interesting things is, I hate the clock, but I'm insistent that I bring my sets down exactly on time, because you know what I'm like.
That's just you.
It is just
that. How do you insist you bring your sets down exactly on time? I mean, especially if it's a bit free form and you're just...
It's not a bit free form. I know exactly what's going on. I mean, yes, when we get to the solos.
Oh, my God.
And now we get free form, Jack.
Andy Oliver, look, you have been on the kitchen cabinet for 10 years.
Yes.
Nothing is free form in that show when I'm in charge.
No, indeed. In fact, this week he said to us, so he used to give us hand signals, and this week he said to us, if I look at you...
And me and Andy went, what? If you look at us, what? What's going to happen? We're going to burst into flames. Fucking dragons are going to come up from underneath the stage. What's going to happen if you look at us? And we're supposed to intuit now from the light in his eye.
We will return to the fuck off finger. Which is,
yes, we like the fuck off finger because we know where we are with the fuck off finger.
There is the index and thumb just a little close together, which indicates short answer. And there is that finger, which is the index finger right up, which means stop.
Yes, and it's like, I told you once, and I know you fucking saw me.
No, but Jay, I'm the same. I like infrastructure, I like rules, I like organisation.
I have to say, every so often, the saxophonist and I do kind of forget that we're meant to stop.
You would have died with Ritrigan Panic. We were so unruly. You would have fucking hated it. Our poor tour manager used to get us together in an airport, and there were so many of us. There were like 12 of us, and we were like teenagers, and we were drunk. We were a fucking nightmare. And he'd sort of get like 8 of us and go, now stand there. I'm going to go and get the fucking rest of them. And then he'd go and find the other however many, come back, and there'd be four fucking gone. And he literally was like, sweating. He had to leave.
Dave Lewis, who's the sax player with us, is also tenor in the Blockheads.
Oh, I love the Blockheads.
And they tour with various people, having taken, including Phil Jupitus for a while, taking the injury spot.
Phil Jupitus took the injury spot?
Yeah.
What?
You've got to have a performer who can sprechen sang those songs. Jupitus was the frontman for about 2 years.
I had no idea either. Wow.
Ian Dury was one of the most exceptional human beings. Did you ever meet Ian Dury?
I didn't.
No. He was always so sweet and kind to me. He was really good friends with Nana's dad, with Don Cherry. He went and spent time with them in Sweden, out of the house in the countryside and stuff. He was a real thinker. He was a smart, smart man. He was one of those people, actually, not unlike yourself, in that some people were probably a bit scared of him, but actually if you knew him underneath the kind of, you know, horny carapace or whatever, he was the sweetest, smartest, kind. Like, I sat on the top of Primrose Hill with him one day doing this interview, and he said, you all right, babe? And I was like, and a bit depressed. These kind of grey days really do. It's like a really grey overhanging day. And you know, he was an art teacher.
Yeah.
So he said, grey, what's grey? And I said, the sky, look at it. He said, that's not grey, look at it. And he started talking to me about all the different hues of pale blue and grey and silver. And suddenly, this awful Tuesday, February, shitty, awful day became this magical thing. He had magic in him. He had the ability to turn a shitty day into magic.
Now, can I say this, as the microphones are here, and I've said this to Andy before, but you're here, Makita. I loved your the Pet Pot Diaries. Fantastic cookbook, available from all good booksellers and a few bad ones too. Go and get it, because it's got recipes for things, you know, serves 27. It's fantastic.
He was like, I've never read a book that's got recipes.
I am gagging for you to write a memoir from 1978 to 1982, because you were fucking there.
I mean, the only thing is, Jay, is I'd have to be able to remember.
She doesn't remember
the clues in the name.
I'm like, that's amazing. Was that probably when you were hanging out, blah, blah? And where was that? She said, I don't fucking know. What were you up to?
I was on the fringes of bits of that world, outside the wagon. Right. I knew various people who were in it and out of it, and you were there.
Well, in the middle of it. But you know the thing about life? Is that you're not like living your life thinking, oh, this is an amazing moment that I'm going to be talking about in 30 years' time, unless you're a real dick, obviously. You don't think about it like that, and I don't think about it like that, and I was thinking,
you know when you get really old, you start to recall your childhood really clearly at that point?
Probably about 70, she'll remember her 20s.
Yeah.
No, I just don't, you know what it is? I'm not very linear. So I'm not sure when things happened in relation to, say, today. Do you know what I mean? It's like people go, sir, back in, you know, when was that? I'm like, I don't know.
92, 82. Pre-child, post-child?
Sometimes I can work that. It does help.
Well, hang on. How old were you when Makita came along?
I was 20.
Oh, bless.
I know. If only I'd known.
That was so planned, wasn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. So planned.
Absolutely.
No, I mean, obviously it wasn't planned. You know, I don't regret any of it. I do. There was a moment when I was. It's all right. That's all right.
Do you know what? I don't regret it.
No, I don't.
Despite everything you might think.
Despite everything,
I actually don't regret it sometimes.
Okay, I just want to talk about it very briefly, not for too long. MasterChef. So you won MasterChef.
I think you must.
Yeah, I mean, he brought it up.
I was all like, Mum, Jay's not going to want to talk about MasterChef. She's like, I think he will.
What do you mean he's not?
Don't.
Because I have never met him.
Do you know, not for long enough to know MasterChef.
Because I know before really we go into MasterChef, I wanted to ask how you feel about being on the telly. Because was it in your grand plans? If you're a food critic, it's not the most obvious thing to suddenly have, and you really are quite well known and famous now, and on TV a lot of the time. But it's the truth. I remember what it was like suddenly being well known. It's fucking weird.
Slightly less weird because I grew up with it. Jay, I grew up with it too.
So I thought, I understand this. Then it happened to me. I was like, no, this is weird.
I mean, it happened by degrees. And for a long while, I craved it. There was a period when I craved it.
Oh, did you?
And I would say it was in the 90s when I thought it was the next thing. But it didn't happen and nobody wanted me. But I had a very successful jobbing newspaper career, and I was already writing books, and it was fine doing a bit of radio. And I thought, the next thing is TV, the Royal. And nobody wanted me. Nothing got commissioned. And it was sort of at the point when I gave up being interested in it when it happened.
You let it go.
And now, honestly, there was a period when I was deeply involved in it, when I was on the one show, I remember one year, 2011, I think it was, I did 48 VTs for them, was on the couch 55 times a day. I mean, not like I know the numbers.
It was that much fun.
I did dispatches. And the honest truth is that kind of factual television, I hate. I don't like the process. I love radio. I love the show that Andy and I do. It is a jewel. I work with brilliant, brilliant people. When they're all on fire, you just sit back and let them do their thing. And the audience, a live audience, is fantastic.
Can I just say, he never sits back and lets do our thing. It's just not just
bloody do.
You need to tell me,
not really.
And this is slightly controversial. Radio attracts some very bright people. I didn't always find in the kind of factual documentaries the greatest journalists. I'm sure they're out there, but I didn't get
there to. There is something really brilliant, I think. We talked about this today, about radio, which is, I think, the intimacy. There's something about not having cameras and all of that stuff going on that where you're just... You can kind of forget about the mechanics of things in a way that you can't really do with telly. You sort of have to pretend to or try to with telly because that's how telly is good. But actually with radio, it's a bit... I always think it's a bit like... Do you remember Crossed Lines when we were a kid? And you could pick up the phone and you...
Yeah.
And you get a cross line. Brilliant radio is a bit like getting a cross line on the old telephonogram.
Yeah.
There are things like MasterChef, which I love.
Yeah.
And they are very, very simple and clean... I don't mind studio.
I love studio-based
TV. Absolutely great.
Yep.
I love the process of MasterChef. I've been on it for 18 years.
No, is that how long it's been?
No, it's been going with John and Greg for 20.
No, but you've been on it for 18 years.
I've been a judge, playing the critics role for 18 years. There are two things to say. One, it's had an awful lot of fun. Two, it's a privilege. I will move anything in my diary to make sure I'm available for those filming days. Yep. Because three...
Yeah, we wouldn't have an audience otherwise.
If you want to have a reasonable public profile but not do too much television, do MasterChef.
Right. Perfect.
A massive audience, massive reach, gets repeated at various times.
How long does it take to make?
We shoot for a day for each episode.
What?
And that's it. It's very compact and they know what they're doing and great.
How do you feel about live telly?
Oh, I loved live telly.
Yeah. So do I. Because
it's like a gig.
But I didn't. Yes, it's a gig.
Yes.
And you can't take
it back. I love that you can't take it back. No. How can you do it a second time and mean it? And that is the thing that drives me and Makita absolutely nuts, especially when you're working with people who don't do all this business. And they go, so when Andy said, can you laugh? And then can you? It's like, no, because she sells tomatoes. It's not a job.
As you said earlier about a joke, you said it's funny because it's true. The truth is just always better in broadcasting, I believe.
The real laugh, the trip up, the whatever.
The mess.
Show the mess.
The truth is that when we're on stage, things very often go wrong.
Yeah.
And there are two ways of dealing with it. One is... you just carry on and people don't know because they don't know.
Yeah, and you all
and
go,
sometimes you just show it.
Yes.
And actually the showing of the going wrong is one of the pleasures for the audience. That's the great thing about live, if you're comfortable with it.
Yeah. I love live telly. I love anything that's... And maybe it's because I kind of almost grew up doing that stuff, you know, my teens and all of that. So I'm used to that kind of energy where you're like... And then you're just in, and then next thing you know, it's done, and you're kind of slightly shaking from the adrenaline of it all, and you're not quite sure what happened. And some of it was brilliant, you think, maybe, and some of it was really awful, perhaps, and you're not really sure what's going to take you a minute to kind of, or two, to come down from it. And I just love that energy, that cycle of energy.
Which is all thrill seekers, really, aren't we? Maybe.
Oh, the smell of the electricity. All right, so I should tell you the story of that episode of MasterChef.
The winning one?
The winning one.
Oh, right. Oh, we're back to the winning, sorry.
I'm aware we're on the clock.
Well done.
So, there is a backstory to this. And it's slightly complicated and self-serving, but I'm not embarrassed about it.
Well, good.
Okay. Self-promotion about to happen. I have my first cookbook coming out in September.
Oh, shit.
Is it your first cookbook?
Yeah. It's not the first book with recipes, but it's the first proper cookbook.
Right.
It is to mark my 25 years as a restaurant critic.
Lordy.
And it's me...
Congratulations.
25 years.
Nobody should have a column on the newspaper for 25 years, but I've done it.
Quarter of a century.
And it is me reverse engineering or coming up with versions of dishes inspired by my favourite dishes of those 25 years with lots of memoir and stories and stuff.
I
became very conscious as I was writing this that people would say, but are these really his recipes and can he cook? And I've got to deal with this. And this idea formed in my head that the only way to deal with this was to try and convince MasterChef to do an episode with the critics cooked off against
each other. It was your idea.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, you're a genius.
I didn't know that.
Wow.
Do they even know this?
Yes, they do.
I mean, do they actually know this?
Well,
plotted it. I mean, I know that you put the idea to them.
It was their idea.
Between Christmas and New Year, 2022, I run into David Ambler, who is the series producer of MasterChef in Brockwell Park by Brockwell Lido, because we live near each other.
Serendipitous.
And I just blurt it out. I say, do you know the thing everybody wants to see? That's the critic cook. And I walk back from there thinking, will he? And lo and behold, he did. He got it commissioned. We shot it in April of 2023. My calculation went in two directions. One was, if it's a disaster and I blow out and I screw up, this is terrible. But I reckoned I wouldn't blow out. I didn't think I'd win. Yeah. I just thought it would be okay because I reckoned I'd been cooking for the book for a long time and I can cook. And I thought it would be fine. But if it went okay and the recipes I would choose would mostly be from the book, it would be all right. Went pretty well.
Oh, God, didn't it go well? Didn't it go bloody well? I mean, but I like that because it's still a risk. Do you know what I mean?
There was a risk. And it wasn't just a risk for us, actually. It was a risk for MasterChef itself.
Yes.
Because if the five of us who were their critics...
We're talking standard.
Grace Dent, William Sitwell, yep. Jimmy Famuera, Leila Kazim and me, if we had turned out to be shockingly bad cooks...
It fucks up the whole history.
We wouldn't just have undermined ourselves. We would have undermined a whole section of MasterChef.
Yeah. And your careers. Yes.
Yeah, it would have been...
It was high stakes.
The fact I won, put it to one side, but everybody did. Everybody, well, we don't really put it to one side. Did
briefly,
I say I won?
Briefly,
just there.
Briefly.
But nobody blew out. Nobody.
No,
did everybody everybody did very
we
well.
I know, it's so hysterical.
This is what he was worried about. Yeah. This exact thing was what he was really
worried
about.
By the time we'd be drinking also, and then we start taking the piss out of it. But actually, we've been very loving, haven't we?
I mean, we love you.
No, but that really is extraordinary. I love that you planted the seed because that was a risk for you and the history of MasterChef.
Here's a very cool thing.
Legacy of MasterChef. Toying with it.
We shot on 2 days, a Monday and Tuesday in April. And there was a lot of hurry up and wait, as we know from TV. And on the Monday, we've been through makeup and we're sitting in the green room area and suddenly all of our phones ping and we look down and it's an email from MasterChef booking us for the next series.
Yes.
Very, very classy. Yes. They were basically saying, whatever happens now, you are still on this show. It was incredibly classy.
Yeah.
Very nice one.
I was just going to say this one thing, then you can say it. When the first thing you cook, when you cooked your ribs.
Yeah.
And you want, everybody was like, the ribs are amazing, the ribs are amazing.
Were,
and you went, can I have one? And then you took one and you walked back across, you looked at the camera and you went, I like shouted at my telly. I went, Jay Rayner, stop winking at the telly.
Did I wink at the
telly? You winked at the telly and you ate your rib. And I thought, oh my God,
but
thank God.
Everybody loved it.
I loved it, but I was literally shouting at you.
Can I ask you this? I really am not bragging about this because this is quite a while ago, but I won Bake Off and very unexpectedly because I can't bake. I won Bake Off.
You won Bake Off?
You can. No, my cousin is a patisserie chef and she taught me over FaceTime over 5 days.
Everybody gets taught at some point in some way.
I'm a baker now. Thank you, Pat.
And then, I mean, she literally had not baked anything at all ever in her life. Her cousin did 5 days on FaceTime and then she won Bake Off.
It's pretty impressive.
And it does. It feels fucking good to win. It really feels great to win things. But what I want to ask you is, I filmed mine in July and I had to wait till Christmas. April, you filmed yours. So I had to decide what the win meant for me without being able to share it. Because I couldn't tell anyone for what, 7 months? You had a bit longer.
What, nobody?
No.
Not even her?
I mean, I couldn't tell her. She came.
I had to
but I couldn't
to
tell
me. All the people I wanted to tell, which was like most people I saw in the street any time of the day.
I did tell a few people. I told my publishers, because I wanted them to know how bloody lucky they were to have me. Because I was packing them a marketing campaign. I mean, you know, all the dishes I cooked, the recipes are available in the book.
They are
published in September. And I thought it was a useful thing for them to know. It was basically a relief. I was extremely relieved.
Actually, that was what the rib moment was. That you were going, thank fuck for that.
Thank fuck for that. Yeah. Who did you see as your greatest threat? Who also did very well and you were like...
Sitwell. You didn't feel threatened.
Was it Sitwell? Sitwell.
Look, Dent, no, no, who when was I it? Say you didn't feel threatened, honestly, when I say he didn't feel threatened, actually, that's not what I meant. Right. What I meant was I had the impression, I wasn't in the room, but I had the impression that the four of you were in it together, supporting each other, a bit scared together.
Actually, it's true.
And that you were all relieved together as well.
Yes. I think that thing you said just really rang home with me, where it's amazing to have the jobs that we have. To do what we do and to be around, for me, the idea that I spend two and a half, three months a year around some of the best or most accomplished or chefs that are like really pushing themselves creatively, like up and down the country every single year, is quite extraordinary. And for me, it inspires me creatively to do more things and to push myself. And I think as a creative person, being around other creative people is incredibly important, right? What I want to talk about, just very, very quickly, and I just, because I'm slightly obsessed, is this whole Michelin scenario, right? So Jockey just won a Michelin star. Jockey, Chizuru, Okoro just won. These are landmark things. Jockey's the second black woman in the world to win a Michelin star, the first one in this country to win a Michelin star. Is Michelin important? Do you think it, does it matter, Jay?
Every profession needs prizes and things to aim at. Thank God for the prizes and awards circuit, because I often get booked to present them. They're important things. And I'm delighted that people are able to win those prizes. I personally find it very hard to engage with Michelin. Mm. It is striking that it has taken until 2024 for us to be talking about black chefs winning Michelin stars as if they've welcomed you in.
To a club.
Why has it taken so bloody long?
Indeed.
And on the one hand, you can be delighted and say, what a brilliant achievement. On the other hand, you say, what fucking kept you?
Yes.
Because it's not like there haven't been brilliant black chefs cooking for decades.
Yeah.
And
what
the
fucking
greatest achievement of Michelin is to make everybody else own their star rating system.
Yes.
So that when stars come out, people go, well, I don't think that's a 2-star. It must be a 1-star. I think it should be a 3-star.
Yeah, yeah.
And you go, no, it's what Michelin said, because they're the people who keep turning
and
out
they
to
know.
They're the people who bestow it, and they're the people who deign to give it to you.
Yeah.
So prizes, awards are wonderful. I've had a few. You've had a few. You know, they're all great. And more to the point, if winning that star brings people to her food, her brilliant food, because I reviewed it when it was in Brixton, that's fantastic. But I just ask the question, Michelin, what kept you?
What kept you? And I completely agree with you. And also, the other part I want to ask you is, do you think it's a guarantee of excellence?
No.
Thank you.
Here is the interesting thing.
Yes.
I think you are more likely to find an interesting meal at 1-star. Yeah. Above that, it gets into bangles and balls.
And it gets so caught up in its own notion of itself.
Isn't it more than, I mean, doesn't as you get higher up in the stars, isn't it also about the number of members of staff there are?
It's all 50 people to make it. It doesn't
mean the food.
And if Michelin actually meant anything, they wouldn't have to keep saying, look, we've just given 2 stars to a West African restaurant or a Chinese restaurant or an Indian restaurant. It wouldn't be a debate in 2024.
Doesn't that mean that there's time to for a different set of awards to
expand our parameters of how we measure excellence, I suppose?
Yeah.
But actually, I think
you should leave it up to one person on a Sunday newspaper.
I wonder who that person
is. Is this the way we're going out, Jay?
Yeah.
Are you saying
that was him? I heard that. He knows that we're coming to the end of it. That was his
coming out bit. I know.
And now Pat Belcher.
There's nothing you like more than a deadline, Andy Oliver.
And
we
then
know
the
that.
Bed will come in, and then it will go into the drum beat. And they just ended this for us. Should we give him a cheers just
Pat
in case?
And Jay, thank you.
Thank you for coming to our table.
Absolute delight.
Let us talk to you for another 3.5 hours.
Literally, I'm in love with you. Good. I'm in love with your boots. I'm in love with your chat. I'm in love with the vibe.
I'm in love with you too.
He's going to get so annoyed.
Come listen to me sing.
I'm totally coming to this.
Please
come.
And apparently some guy plays the piano when you do it.
Some guy plays the piano,
we'll
but I
there.
Have to say, I fucking held the stage.
Yes!
Say
on
it.
That note,
you make that end of podcast.
On that note.
She's like, let me just end
that's
this episode.
That's your end right there. There's
I'm
your
so
cut
sorry,
right
Jay.
There.
We got one now.
Do you normally do a fade on just your laughter at the end of all that?
We'll do the fade.
Well, I didn't even have to do my job. I just said to Jay, as he left, I went, thank you for enabling me to not even do my job. I literally just sat enraptured by the storyteller.
He is a raconteur, is he not? He is a raconteur, and so is Pat.
Oh, God.
Pat, I'm sorry. I mean, I've known Jay for a long time, 10, 11 years we've established. Pat is my new revelation.
From when Jay first walked in, so warm, so lovely. But, you know, he's quite an imposing figure, but very gentle energy. But then once he was around the table with two women that he knows as well as you two, obviously he knows Pat a lot better, but women that love him and that have been in his life for a long time, his wife and a very old friend.
Yeah.
It was just like, he got very sweet and giggly
Jay
and soft.
Jay is very sweet. He's one of those people, I love him dearly, so I don't want to say loads of really nice things about him, but he has got a massive intellect. Yes. He's incredibly talented and he's really accomplished. And that is intimidating for a lot of people.
But
underneath all of those things, he's sweet, he's funny, he's kind, he's curious, he's gentle, and he's compassionate.
Also, Jay has taught me today how to take a compliment. You say, yes, yes, I'll take a bit more of that. And have you got anything else?
You were amazing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And keep it going. What else? Thank God for Jay Rayner and Pat.
And thank God for stirring it up. Yep. Good idea, Makita Oliver.
Thank you. That was a good idea.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say about it?
No, that's enough.
Okay.
For today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.